In olden days, a glimpse of stocking was looked on as something shocking. But now God knows, anything goes. Good offers too.
Teachers and Writers Collaborative on WNYE-FM presents Anything Goes. I am Ann Whitehouse, and today I am reading from my novel, Fall Love. In the spring of 1980, Althea Montgomery, a 26-year-old artist living on Manhattan's Upper West Side, met a very good-looking dancer named Paul Carmichael, who also lived in the neighborhood. She found herself terribly attracted to him, and curious about his life with Bryce Crawford in a penthouse apartment with a roof garden and sweeping views of the Hudson River. Even on vacation on Block Island in August, Althea couldn't put Paul out of her mind, and when she discovered that Bryce was away from New York, she impulsively invited Paul to visit her. Yet she hadn't counted on falling in love with Paul as desperately as she did, nor was she prepared for the shock of discovering that her friend, Jean Mann, who soon came out to Block Island to visit her and drive her home, had also met Paul under equally accidental circumstances and was clearly attracted to him too. Unable to resist Paul's seductions, Althea succumbed to his spell. But once she, Jean, and Paul returned to New York, her sufferings began. Not only did Paul instantly cut off contact with her, but she also found herself completely estranged from Jean as a result. Thinking, erroneously as it turned out, that Paul had been reunited with Bryce, she was afraid of angering him by telephoning him at home, and she didn't know how to reach him otherwise. She expected she would eventually run into him in the neighborhood, as she had before, but such chance encounters were not forthcoming. Althea spent a lonely and despairing autumn wondering what she had gotten herself into, yet paralyzed by the memory of her desire. When a contact at last occurred, it was initiated by Paul, who sent Althea a ticket to the opening night performance of his company, the Curt Matthews Dancers, at the Joyce Theater on November 16th. Seeing Paul on stage gave Althea an opportunity to examine feelings which she had been keeping carefully under wraps. Summoning her courage, she approached Paul after the performance. Sensing the electricity that was still between them, she got him to agree to meet her for tea during the week, a meeting which he first postponed and then rescheduled. In the meantime, Jean, whom Paul had also invited to his opening night at the Joyce Theater, had spotted Althea after the performance and left instantly to avoid her. Afterwards, regretting her cowardice, Jean called Althea and, confronting resistance and hostility, persuaded her to meet for lunch on the upcoming Saturday, November 22nd. The episode I am about to read from Chapter 16 describes the reunion between Paul and Althea at a cafe on Wednesday afternoon, November 19th. At this meeting, which Althea has dreamed about for so long, she recognizes her love for Paul as both real and futile. And what of Paul? Why has this man, who loves mainly other men, become involved not only with Althea, but with Jean as well? In part, it was out of a wish to get even with Bryce, who Paul felt had abandoned him in the middle of summer to go home to Mississippi to a family he had always bitterly disparaged. Yet, if it was primarily revenge that motivated Paul, he found himself with more than he had bargained for. He got carried away by himself. In spite of himself, he found himself affected by Althea in ways he hadn't anticipated and which he resisted. His heartlessness was in fact a defense against his vulnerability. A dancer admired for his strength, Paul knew he was weak, but it took some time for the other characters to learn it too. Eventually, they all acknowledge Paul's weakness, but by this time, Paul's life has been definitively and irrevocably altered with unforeseen consequences. Yet, for now, let's go back and give our attention to Althea and to Paul, meeting after a long estrangement. On a golden afternoon, Paul came strolling across Central Park from the east side to meet Althea. This Wednesday was so warm that happiness seemed to float in the air. 77 degrees, a record high for November 19th, Paul had heard announced over the radio when he'd stopped to buy mints at a drugstore on Madison Avenue. In the park, he heard seagulls and thought of the sea. At the edge of the great lawn, he saw them wheeling and settling. Behind him, Belvedere Castle, where the temperature was recorded, stood on its high, dark cliff. It's the kind of day, he thought, that makes you feel as if you'll live forever. Just as he crossed the park's western boundary, he noticed a youth approaching the entrance, whose beauty matched the day's. He reminded Paul of Christopher in the Gallery of Musical Instruments in Boston. He had dark curly hair, a Grecian profile. He was wearing jeans and a t-shirt that revealed his smooth, rippling arms. Observing him, Paul's mood changed. He felt a pang, thinking that he would never again be so young. The boy's smile was a flash of impersonal goodwill. Then, entering the park, he broke into a run, calling out to companions unseen by Paul, who had turned his back and was waiting for the light to cross the avenue. Paul walked south and then headed west on a side street. A bell tolled the hour, thrice, thrilling and chilling his heart. When he reached the cafe, Althea was waiting for him outside at one of the small round tables placed right on the sidewalk. She was sitting peacefully, watching the street. Her menu was open, and he assumed that she hadn't yet ordered. She rose to greet him, stately, her hair flowing over her shoulders. She was dressed plainly in a dark sweater and jeans. She stood a little stiffly, as if unsure what to do. His forefinger grazed her cheekbone. Then he stepped back. Althea, I've kept you waiting. Yes, you have. Her voice was low, her complexion pale next to her clothing. Her eyes were gray, flecked with yellow, like a distant horizon. Her face so smooth it seemed nearly expressionless, emphasizing the strong, full curves of her jaw and cheek. Yet she was not really so composed. I thought we'd sit outside, she said, interrupting the silence she had opened between them. It's so warm. Fine. Their chairs were set beside each other at angles facing the street, not opposite, not touching. The young waitress brought Paul a menu. He scanned it rapidly. I'll have something rich and gooey, chocolate mousse cake and an espresso. And you? He nodded to Althea. A lemon ice, because it feels like summer. As the waitress departed, she continued, I got the review of your performance from Monday's Times. I thought you'd want an extra copy. She opened her purse, unfolded the clipping, and laid it on the table. He didn't glance at it. Are you trying to torture me? He asked. I thought it was good. Well, most of it anyway. Paul stared at her as though in disbelief. Althea felt defensive. She wanted him to know she was his champion. Critics have to express reservations, she pleaded. That's their job. They can't love everything. Remember, they're only critics. You're the artist. Where do they get off? Paul complained. They're so self-important. I hate it when they write about the vocabulary of dance. They're writers. They're trying to find a connection to words. Well, they could be more original. He took the clipping, dated November 17th, 1980, and read from it. The audience got a special treat in the Kurt Matthews Dancers opening performance at the Joyce Theater on Sunday night. Mr. Matthews' lead dancer, Paul Carmichael, Eric and Hector have already given me grief about that, Paul interjected. Premiered his first creation, a solo dance called Savage Landscape. Notwithstanding the terrible title, this is an interesting piece which seems influenced by the Japanese form of dance called Buto. Well, I'll skip the dissertation, Paul said, and head straight to the point, such as it is. There were some tantalizing sequences which Mr. Carmichael performed well, but his intent wasn't always clear. His vocabulary is esoteric, Paul snorted with disgust, then skipped to the last line. Still, he's someone to watch for in the future. Blah, blah, blah. Althea laughed. Well, I'm one to talk. I've never been reviewed. I'm terrified. Sometimes I think I'd rather not be reviewed. But if I'm ever to get anywhere, I realize I'm going to have to change my attitude. Still, I thought this part was good, about alchemy. She rotated the clipping on the table and read. Paul Carmichael stood out among the group. He exhibits a good performance quality, with striking lines, and is at ease on stage. That's true, she commented, hoping to please him. What bothers me is the implication that I'm a dancer, not a choreographer, and I ought to stick to what I know. But this review didn't say that at all. The one in Newsday did. I didn't see it. Have there been others? I'm waiting for the weeklies, not exactly with bated breath. I'd like to say that the effect of the reviews is like water off a duck's back, but it's not true. However, I'm trying not to care too much. The audiences matter to me more than the critics. And you know, I think I really want my audiences to be speechless. But they could just as well be speechless with horror, shock, or dismay, as speechless with delight. That's true. But to me, that's preferable to the ready-made responses that are about as automatic as reflexes. I mean, when the audience thinks, that looks pretty, or else, that's a difficult execution, and then claps and immediately forgets about it. I want my audiences to have to digest what they've seen. I want to create a kind of magic so they're not quite sure of what they've experienced. As he spoke, Althea found herself recalling his performance, feeling again the sharp pang when she'd recognized him on stage, existing in another realm, beautiful and unreachable and utterly remote. Before she could respond to his comment, their order arrived. An imposing hill of pale blonde ice in a glass tumbler, a plump dark wedge of cake, and black coffee in a small, thick china cup. The waitress placed the check face down, one corner under the edge of Paul's saucer, and left them to attend to the next table. Looks great, commented Paul, spreading his napkin over his lap. Do you always eat like this before a performance? It's not for hours. I don't eat just before. I really eat a lot afterwards, whatever I want. He grinned and took a huge first bite. Althea scooped up her ice with a long-handled spoon, eating it slowly, dreamily letting it melt on her tongue. The coldness, the sour taste, and grainy texture soothed her. It felt unreal to be consuming an ice in the warm sun of November with Paul beside her. He ate quickly but fastidiously, with evident relish. She wondered if he would offer her a taste, but he didn't. She repressed a counteroffer of her own, though inwardly savoring the fantasy of holding the spoon up to his mouth and his sucking up the contents of it. He finished his cake, pressing his fork to the plate to get the last crumbs. Her ice was a diminished, still gleaming heap, melting into a little pond. She gazed at him, a smile curving her cold lips, and he watched her, smiling back. Without speaking another word, they acknowledged the intimacy between them in that look, and she luxuriated in what seemed to her was being admitted without actually being said. It felt like a freedom not to need to say it while she sat beside Paul in the warm sun. But he was not content. He had to speak. "What are you hiding, Althea?" he asked gently. She had been uplifted. Now she was being carefully set down. She sighed, regretting his question, regretting having to make her reply explicit in words. "I was thinking of how easy it is to be with you." "But I'm a difficult person. Most people think it's hard to be with me." "I know that." She watched as he stirred sugar into his coffee and took a small sip. "Right now I find you restful to be with." He laughed. "That's a new one." She smiled and then felt her smile grow melancholy. "It's horrible to be the one who waits, Paul." "I've been away, you know," he said. "I was on tour." "How would I know?" Her voice was quiet and bitter. "That's true. I didn't tell you. I've been up in New England for over a month, working very hard, dancing all the time. That's where I made up my dance." He looked her straight in the face. "To tell the truth, I hardly thought of anything else." She didn't flinch or take offense. "Believe me, I understand artistic obsession. You know, I'd like to see your dance again." "You'll have a chance, but not tonight. Tonight's the other program." "Will you change the dance because of the reviews?" "I'll probably change it in spite of the reviews. To spite the reviewers. Maybe I'll change the title. Do you really think it's terrible? Do you have any ideas?" "I don't know. No." Their conversation had come close to her heart and then veered off. Though afraid, she was determined to bring it back again. "You explained about the last month, but what about before that, Paul? Why didn't you get in touch with me?" "I thought it better not to." "Better for you." "Oh, Althea." She heard the exasperation in his voice and the pity. "Has it really been so hard?" he asked, this time gently. Her assent was a monotone, so low it could scarcely be heard. Still, she was dry-eyed. A truck came rumbling down the narrow side street, drowning out his comment. She looked at the doll fastened to the grill on the front, like the figurehead of a ship, a custom she had never heard described but had often noticed. The doll was battered and dirty by now from its voyages through city streets. A dissolve and then distance, the distance between them. She thought that she still felt desire for him, but it was a different desire, having existed so long in his absence. She had no choice. That was clear. Or, rather, her only choice was to say no. As Paul watched Althea, he was aware of her beauty, sparer than in the summer, her tan long faded to the pallor of November. It was as if she were worn to a translucency, like old alabaster. He thought of taking her hand and thought twice. He couldn't help, when she hung her head, the sudden thrill through his heart, the exquisite pleasure that came of seeing her suffer. The sensation was so delicately wrought in him that at first he hardly understood it, and he didn't do it justice. His annoyance and pity didn't pass, but, as he divined her, he felt a kind of exultation compounded of both happiness and pain. Yet he was hardly able at first to show it. Unable to understand him, she looked at him questioningly and shook her head. You've puzzled me, and I puzzled myself. I think perhaps in part you always meant to, yet I can't entirely believe it. He didn't laugh. A look of strain came over his face, making him haggard. It was a complete change. For the first time, he appeared used to Althea, even tarnished. It was a flash of revelation, a new thought of him, as diminished as herself. The transcendence, the empowering energy that she had felt from him, they were gone. This Paul was not superhuman, but mortal and flawed. Yet the sight of him was still affecting to her. The flicker of desire was in them both. She'd sensed it the instant he greeted her by touching her cheek. What she had really been trying to tell him, she reflected, was that it was easier to be with him than to long for him and to be without him. It made her sad to remember all the times when she was alone and had thought of him with such desire. She couldn't bear for him to know that. Yet, in some sense, she wanted him to have to know it. However, what good could that possibly do her, she thought, as they sat beside each other, not touching, their desserts consumed. That was an amazing moment, she recalled, changing the subject, when those flowers came flying on the stage. They were from Bryce, weren't they? I looked for him afterwards, and I didn't see him. No, they weren't from Bryce. The roses were Jean's offering, then? Althea sounded incredulous. No. I didn't think so. It's not like her to make a gesture like that. Besides, she can barely throw. Paul laughed. It's true. I should know, Althea went on. We were in junior high school gym class together. Who did send the roses? A secret admirer. Come on, Paul. Okay. Don't believe me. You don't think I have secret admirers? He was enjoying this, she could tell, and she felt exasperated. She refused to indulge him. But Jean was there, wasn't she, at your opening night? Yes. Did you see her? No, he said, meeting her eyes directly. She sent me a note with the usher, saying that she would look for me, but I found you instead. Did she? Althea heard a resistance in Paul's tone and decided not to pursue the topic, although this information by itself was a frail intelligence to meet Jean with on Saturday against all that she did not know. Her next question, however, was even less welcome. How is Bryce? Was followed by a pause in which Paul said nothing. He simply sat still and waited, as if he had not heard. A delivery boy whizzed by on a bike, ringing his bell for no reason at all. The sound, rather gentle for a warning, welled up in the silence. Without understanding why, she inferred that she was on dangerous ground, that Paul was keeping her at length, as if she were his adversary. We've spent all this time talking about me and my dance, and none about you and your painting. How's it going? Any shows coming up? He's trying to disarm me, she thought. She felt as if she were being called on to play a part, to maintain a structure of courtesy, and she submitted. Shows? I don't even have a dealer yet. I suppose I ought to do the round of galleries with slides, but I've been putting it off. I have a number of excuses. I haven't yet made the slides, and I don't know where to begin. I don't want to go about it blindly, approaching dealers who won't be interested in my work. I'm not part of any trendy scene, and I don't have any connections. I need to research the different galleries, but I haven't had the time or the inclination. It puts me off to think about marketing my work while I'm in the midst of doing it. I want to finish these paintings first. They're my most recent, and I hope my best. What paintings are they? the ones I was working on Block Island.
Still?
Yes. I haven't seen them yet.
No.
I thought you would have offered if you'd wanted me to see them. Paul sounded defensive. I was waiting for you to ask.
I didn't know that.
Well, I'd like to see them now if you'd care to show them.
Between us are taboos, she thought, set by him, that I can't bring myself to break, but my paintings are no longer one of them.
You can if you like.
Maybe I'll drop by one of these days.
Come to think of it, perhaps you ought to wait until they're finished. I hope it won't be too long now. I'm trying to imagine them completed, and then complete them.
Maybe you won't know they're done until they are.
Maybe. In her mind's eye, she pictured her canvases waiting for her in the quiet dark of her studio. They were relics of her past, she thought, or recreations of it. Will he look at them, she wondered, and remember Block Island? Out of the blue, she recalled some cloud and wind-swept collages she once had seen in a Kirchfitter's exhibition at the Museum of Modern Art. She wondered if they might have influenced her paintings. She recalled watching the somber light on the sea from the deck of the New London Ferry with Paul and Jean beside her. It seemed no effort at all to bring her left hand over Paul's right one, resting by his empty cup on the table. All the while they had been talking, she had ached to touch him. And now, at last, she thrilled to the feel of his long, slender fingers under hers. But she was timid. Her caress was light, and almost instantly she took her hand away. At her touch, Paul started, stifling a cry. Withdrawing, she paused in midair and then laid her hand back over his. He covered her hand with his free hand so that it was sandwiched between both of his. She couldn't speak, flooded by the sensation of the two of them together against the rest of the world. Her being surged. In a second she could be persuaded to give up everything if she could have him, flinging palette knives and brushes behind her. Goodbye, painting. She stared at his mouth. She couldn't help herself. As she raised her eyes to his, she saw him slowly shake his head. Releasing her hand, he declined to kiss her. She would not be asked to give up anything. For Teachers and Writers Collaborative, I'm Ann Whitehouse. Anything Goes is recorded by Tom Ronan and produced by Erwin Gonshack in the studios of WNYE-FM, New York.
Who once knew better words, now only used for letter words, writing prose. Anything goes. If driving fast cars you like, if low bars you like, if old kids.
He declined to kiss her. She would not be asked to give up anything. For Teachers and Writers Collaborative, I'm Ann Whitehouse. Anything Goes is recorded by Tom Ronan and produced by Erwin Gonshack in the studios of WNYE-FM, New York.
Who once knew better words, now only use four letter words, writing prose, anything goes. If driving fast cars you like, if low bar you like, if old